Hi, everyone.
Hello?
Sounds like folks are back.
Yep.
Very good. Well, this is our first clean teleconference of the new year, 2014. This is January the 7th, just so I can put the have the date on the top of the recording. And I just want to welcome everyone, and Happy New Year and all those good things. And first thing we usually do is see if there's any announcements, and then we can talk about the difference between weather and climate.
I am literally sitting in a blizzard.
Sure you are, Sean.
It is actually the first blizzard in Buffalo since 1993.
Oh, really?
Yeah, although Buffalo has a more stringent definition of blizzards than other places in the country.
And in what ways does it differ? Does it mean what?
It requires higher winds and I think lower temperatures, and that happened after the blizzard of 77, and there were in the next year or so there were more storms that were by the standard definition of blizzards, but people in Buffalo said, why are you calling this a blizzard?
I love that.
Because you're hardy folks.
That's right. But it's a pretty serious blizzard, especially where I am. We don't really have all that much snow, but it's horizontal and 20 mile an hour or 30 or maybe even higher winds than that. And it's about five. It's warmed up to about five. And but if you go 10 miles south of me, they've got over 2 feet of snow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish we were getting the snow.
You just got the cold.
Let's see what's the high. I think have we reached zero? I'm not sure. The governor closed the schools.
Which is pretty unheard of for you guys, yeah.
Yeah, the last time was in 1993 or 4, I believe.
Wow.
Oh.
It gives you great respect for penguins and polar bears.
Yeah, seriously. Apparently we're colder than Mars.
Yeah. I love it.
Only portions of Mars. Portions of
Mars.
Yeah,
only portions of Mars. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, to be. Yeah.
Well, it'll
soon be hotter than Venus, so that's the other side of the coin.
There you go.
Well, it's been interesting. I don't know if you guys have been noticing, but there's certainly been a lot of commentary on the media, and I guess that's a good thing. At least what I saw, maybe that just says the sources that I've been watching have actually been making the distinction between weather and climate. So in a sense, that's been helpful. But I don't know whether that's true everywhere.
Well, John Stewart did a very nice job of making fun of Donald Trump and such the other day. So there's effective responses out there, I think.
Yes, good.
But there is a fatigue of talking about the weather phenomena as it relates to climate that is pervasive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just want to, move on and talk about how cold it is and, all the other nice – they want to keep it an environmental weather topic and move on. They don't want to have a real conversation about the implications.
Yeah.
That's what I've seen.
Yeah,
I'm in Florida, the Orlando area, and they never make the connection.
Interesting. Dave, do you want to introduce yourself? I think most of the folks who are on the call right now, we actually know each other by voice. In fact, most of us actually saw each other about a month ago. But Dave, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit? And
yeah, sure. I'm Dave Finnegan, and my program is called Climate Change is Elementary. I go into elementary schools for the day and get the kids, the teachers, and the parents to fill out a family sustainability checklist of all the things they promised to do to reduce their carbon footprint. And then I connect the school to local vendors who can help them to carry out the things that are on the checklist, like installing solar panels or getting an energy audit. And the vendors will give a rebate to the school for family actions. And so it's a self-financing program. The PTA brings us in, and the school can use it as a fundraiser. I've trained 22 people so far to deliver the program, and I'm on a mission to get 100 teams out on the road within the next 3 years delivering the program all over North America.
And what geographic region? This is Jean McGregor at the Evergreen State College. Hi, nice to meet you. What geographic region are you working in now?
Planet Earth. I haven't gone beyond that yet.
Not Mars.
Well, here's my ambition this year. I'm going to join the Great Climate March by going out in front of them by a week or two. And as they cross the country, I'll be delivering programs and training people to deliver programs all along that route that goes from the L.A. Basin to Washington, D.C., from the 1st of March till the 1st of November. Mm-hmm. So if you know anybody along the route, or if you yourself are along the route, then please help me get a school, an elementary school. PTAs pay for this because they have a budget for excellent outside programs, and this is an excellent outside program. And one of the things that it does is remove the obligation that the school might feel to present this controversial subject. I tell the teachers that I'm going to open Pandora's box for them, and they don't have to open it themselves. And from then on, climate change becomes an appropriate topic in that school, whereas they may have been nervous about broaching the topic previous to our visit.
This is Ingrid Zabel in Ithaca, New York. What is the fee for the program?
It's $1,500 for the day, and it's a very intense day. It starts with a teacher's meeting in the morning. We have classes all day for every grade level in the gym. They're big activity sessions with movement and music and slides and fun for the kids. And then we have an assembly at the end of the day, and then that same evening the parents come in and the kids and parents work together on the pre-printed family sustainability checklist, and then they all take the pledge to do everything on the list. And after they've done that, I say, okay, how many of you grown-ups would like to join the green team for the school? And, of course, their kids are sitting right there, so they all raise their hands. And then I say, if your hand is in the air, stand up. If you're standing, come to the front of the room. If you're in the front of the room, put your arms around each other's shoulders and take a bow. Principal, take a picture. We now have a green team at the school. So we kind of hornswoggle them into taking action.
I love it. I think it's a great idea.
And Ithaca is my old stomping ground. I went to Cornell.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
and just enjoyed my 50th reunion there.
Oh. Nice. This is Frank Niepold.
It's here to Seattle, too, so you did your PhD here at the University of Washington. So you're definitely covering it. We'll have to get you to California, though. I guess
I did my master's at Berkeley in public health.
Oh, great! So no wonder you talk about taking on the whole planet.
Yeah. No, I worked for 10 years in East Asia in family planning programs in the '60s, so I've been around.
Yes.
I was in the army in Germany.
Well, Dave, I hope we're going to be able to convince you to do a presentation for us sometime later in the year. That will be great to hear a little bit more about all of this. Excellent.
I sent an email to everybody in the Clean Network.
Yeah.
About 30 minutes.
But there will be more details, I'm sure, that people will want to talk about. So that's good.
Yeah. Happy to meet you.
Before we get going a little bit more, to remind folks, and this is in Tamara's email that she sent out this morning about the Geological Society of America meeting. And the 14th, it's next Tuesday. We need to have some conveners for possibly two sessions for the meeting, which I think, Don, you probably know this better than I do. Is it in October or November this year? I normally know what these are.
I think it's October this year, but actually I don't remember.
I didn't check that, but we know the 14th is the deadline for submission of, I guess it's for the conveners as opposed to, for session proposals, papers. So Tamara's putting a call out for folks who would be interested in helping convene those two sessions. So please contact her if you're interested in doing that. I think as she said, I've had a couple of emails, so I'm just making sure you guys saw the same thing I saw. She said that there were 1.5 days of sessions this past year, and you were deeply involved in all of that, too. So,
October 19th to 22nd.
Through 22nd in Vancouver.
Okay. Oh, it's in Vancouver. Well, good for me.
Yeah. I don't think I'll be going there.
Yeah. Vancouver's a wonderful city to go to.
Beautiful.
But I bet you don't let
that's
you out of the
not
country.
Why I said it. I'd love to go to Vancouver, but, travel being what it is.
Indeed.
I'll be on the Great Climate March.
Are they coming up to Vancouver, too?
No. At that point, they'll be passing through Maryland on the way to Washington, D.C., slogging along 15 miles a day.
That's where you'll pick up, Frank.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be doing a session, but we did a short course this past year on teaching controversial issues, and we've been asked to do a repeat of that, and that involved several Climate Literacy Network folks, Scott Mandia, who else? Peg Steffen. Peg came in electronically, and I think there's a fourth person I'm drawing a blank on who's also a clean person. Short course proposals aren't due until February 3rd, so we've got a little bit more time on that. But I do think I'm hopeful that other people will pick up the torch of putting in session proposals.
So, Don, you're doing that in Vancouver then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Repeating it in Vancouver. Excellent.
Yep.
Good. So, are there any other announcements?
I guess I have one quick one, is just to see how many people on the call or know of other members of the network who might be going to the NCSE meeting in a couple weeks.
Okay. Right.
Is anybody else on the call going to be joining us there?
Nope.
Are you talking about the National Climate Assessment thing?
No, not that one. So the National Council for Science and the Environment, the other NCSE.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Other than has an annual conference in the Washington, D.C. area in January. And this year is on building climate solutions.
Jason Cervenek at Birdpool, I'll be there.
Oh, good.
Oh, fantastic. The reason
I'm wondering,
I bring it up
this, for is, this is Jean McGregor at the Evergreen State College. I'm wondering if after the conference, since lots of us can't go, we could have a conference call reporting on that meeting, because it's going to be a pretty major meeting and bringing together a lot of people from the federal government and media people around this whole climate solutions arena.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, there's the larger climate solutions space, which usually gets absorbed by policy and, big things. But when it gets to education, we get, the invitation is late to the meeting, usually, if you follow where I'm going. And so we have a session that is kind of continuing a conversation that's been done through a series of meetings, a couple of them at AGU and other conversations here in this call. The tri-agency meetings over the years, looking at a public-private partnership on climate change education using the collective impact model as a framework for how to do large-scale impact without all of us being part of one funded organizational activity. And so it's a symposium But we had a meeting, we had a workshop at AGU this year. We had a workshop, a two-day workshop at AGU the previous year. I know this conversation showed up in the tri-agency meetings in October during the government shutdown. So it seems to be a building ahead of steam specific to this one, and then there's the larger Building Climate Solutions meeting we could also ask NCSE to kind of brief us on the larger piece as well.
Mm-hmm. So are the conversations leading to actually something on the ground, or is it more the framing, the rationale, and the need?
So actually, it's the as far as we can tell in the community, the largest flaw in all of our abilities to work is funding. The federal government, you know, is funded since 2007, something in the order of $110 million in climate change education, and a lot of us in the community have been part of that effort. But the federal dollars are beginning to, if not well on their way to drying up in this area. And there'll be, you know, there'll be pieces that'll be going forward, but from other grants, or, you know, maybe somebody will get a DRK-12 at NSF, but it's really not at scale and not commensurate to the challenge before us and the educational role there. And so what we're looking at is kind of the next phase of funding coming from non-public fund sources, but the philanthropic and corporate community aren't focusing on this part of the equation. They tend to focus on lobbying or policy or decision-maker support or stuff like that, not us. And so what we're trying to do is really think through carefully what would that large-scale, high-impact education, community engagement, you know, however you want to characterize it, model be, and could the funding for that, what would it cost, how would we do it? So it is on the ground, but trying to get the funding figured out.
And I think, Frank, just to carry on with that notion, I think many of us are sort of seeing this continuation of that federal funding. There was the Climate Change Education Partnership Phase 1 and then Phase 2, and I've been sort of informally talking about this as sort of Phase 3. If we've done all this experimentation, how do we really start to implement this across the country? And, you know, we have six of the Phase 2 CSEP programs. They're certainly really experimenting very deeply, you know, on certain kinds of approaches that might work. And I envision this as making the argument, okay, now we're into a much broader implementation phase. I mean, that's how I would make the argument to the funding agencies. I'm sure we will come up with much better ones. I can mention that we're going to, just a little bit of promo, next week, Tamara's going to lead a discussion around the collective impact discussions that happened at AGU, one of the events that Frank just talked about. She's going to talk about that, and I think there's actually a document with some summary material actually up on our website. And the following week, we will have what is going to become a monthly joint meeting with the National Climate Assessment, Education Special Affinity Group, and we're going to continue the discussion, and it's really some of the same lines as this, is how to make use of the National Climate Assessment materials in education and how that relates to the broader idea of funding.
I hope
that helps. Yeah, please.
Frank, this is Bora Simmons for Eugene. Hi there. Have you heard anything about the Blue Sky Funders Forum that NAAE has been shepherding for about the last 3 years or so?
Absolutely.
Okay, because it just seems like that's a you know, really nice meshing. I mean, obviously what you're talking about is far more specific to climate change education, but that's broader to environmental ed. Funding.
So I mean, I think the real question, and as we frame this, I mean, there are some that say that climate change education is too narrow, and I can appreciate parts of that. But it does give us the urgency piece that other topics don't generate. And so it's the urgency aspect of you know, we need to do a lot fast in this space. And that's the part that you know, we'll see what excites and gravitates. The two communities of funders are the education people who fund stuff and the climate change people who fund stuff. But the problem is we sit between these two worlds, and thereby they don't, you know, neither one of them funds us. They fund, you know, STEM on one hand or climate change on the other hand, and they don't see the connection, and that's the critical flaw in the philanthropic world's thinking, that we're trying to figure out how to help them get this.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, and
that's the world I live in, guys.
Nicole Arduin at Stanford has done some, you know, good summarizing, looking at the patterns of giving, and it is pretty pitiful. You know, it's like environmental education gets, I mean, as a whole, and most of it actually goes to Outward Bound, gets something like 5% of the environmental giving, and you know that the environmental giving is a small piece of the pie, so it gets. But that's the whole purpose of the Blue Sky Funders Forum, is to try to get those folks together to talk about it and articulate it, and hopefully build some capacity within the funding community around generally environmental ed. But it just seems like it's an area where there could be collaboration, not necessarily one's, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that you know, in these community conversations that we've done over the years, the one of the findings that came out of the AGU discussion last year was that a lot of the funders see the work that we're doing as it relates to education as an endless black hole of funding, that you've put tons of money in and yet the answer is we need more. Before we can really show impact. And I think that the challenge to us is to really think through carefully what the highest value strategic investments are to make the most impact. And that's the challenge we have before us, is what are those things, what do they cost, how would we know we've met success? And until we can figure out a better way of articulating it, I think we're going to struggle capturing the passions and interests and you know, investment.
Yeah, I agree. And just so you know, we're having some of those same conversations within NAAE of how do you make the value-based arguments and the research-based arguments too.
Yep. And so I think, you know, we need to make sure all these conversations are mutually reinforcing and informing and collaborative where they can be without any question. So, you know, and some of us have been part of, you know, all of us are part of multiple worlds. And, you know, I've been in some of the NAAE conversations, others have been in other conversations, and some of us have been engaging different funders. And so I think that one of the values of this network is to make sure that you know, those nodes are connected where that makes sense. So, you know, point always taken.
Any other
comments? It's exciting stuff, guys.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, no.
Well, and the one last thing I will say in this space is, and I think it reinforces what, Scott, you said about phase three, is, and I know the federal program officers who lead the tri-agency grant programs are working on kind of crafting some thought pieces about that this is not the federal government shirking its responsibilities or its investments. It's really that these programs were never built to transition into a large-scale operational deployment. They're not they're not built. It's not appropriate. We don't have the level of funding. It's just never going to happen. But it doesn't mean that the federal investments were not important experiments, but taking an experiment to wide-scale deployment and adoption is, you know, needed, but is, you know, we will not be successful if we wait for the federal government to fund it. It's just not going to happen. And I speak as a federal civil servant here. So
yeah, and speaking as someone who looked at the terrain and tried to figure out, this is Dave Finnegan with the Climate Changes Elementary Program, I tried to figure out what spigot I could turn. I discovered there weren't any, so I said, well, who has money? PTAs have money. They sell a lot of pepperoni pizza. So why don't I tap into that? And what I've discovered is that there is a fountain of pepperoni pizza money out there that we can tap into, and every school has it. So I can go from elementary school to elementary school all over the country and find support without having to go to the funders forum or anything like that, because people are very excited to do this on a local basis. So to the extent that you can localize your fundraising, I think it really helps. We're talking school to school, school by school across the country, about getting $1,500 from each school. It doesn't sound like a lot, but if you do 100 schools in a year, that's $150,000. So that's the way we're looking at it, as something that we're not going to ever have to go to the public trough for. Instead, we can get money from the school. So I encourage people to think that way.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting challenges we have in your, and I completely agree and understand, and I'm perplexed by the idea of a fountain of pepperoni pizza, but we'll let that slide. the idea of the collective impact model is, you know, how do we take what you're doing and incorporate it in with the other initiatives to see if the common focused area of work is actually having a collective impact, meaning your work plus the Alliance for Climate Education plus the Clean Collection plus museum exhibits plus the national parks plus, is there actually a collective impact here? And, you know, a boundary organization has to be established in order to really see whether that is occurring or not. And it, you know, right now it's there's a lot of independent agents working, and it's quite noisy. But there isn't a signal that's been generated. I don't think, maybe in certain locations there is, but I don't think that we are as coordinated or as effective as we could be today.
Yeah, there always needs to be an umbrella organization to put everything into place, and we don't have that within the environmental universe, and in fact there's a lot of silos. But that's why I joined the Great Climate March. So I put the Climate Changes Elementary Program into the Great Climate March, hoping that other people will also join the march, and that by the time we get to D.C. on the 1st of November, there'll be 100,000 people on the mall cheering the marchers on as they come into town. And that's something that I think a lot of people get behind, because it's not just a one-day event like Earth Day. It's something that's going to go on for months and months and get publicity across the country, hopefully nationally as well. So my pitch for everybody is to join the march.
I hear you.
Any other comments? This is great. A good way to start the year.
Yep.
Well, maybe we've got work to get onto and get started, and if we want to sort of close off early today, that's just great for me, at least.
Well, let me. If we've got a couple more minutes, I do have a different ask.
Absolutely.
Is that okay?
Go for it. Yeah, absolutely.
So, and Bora, I'm happy you're with us. So, this you'll see why this relates to some previous conversations. So, some of you know Tom Bowman, who works out of Long Beach, California, does a lot of interesting work, and he helped do the copy editing on the Climate Literacy Guide before it got finalized, and he's been related and working with the climate and energy, to some degree, literacy initiatives for quite some time, so circa 2008. And he approached me at AGU with an interesting and intriguing idea. And so I just wanted to kind of reality check it with you guys. And so what he said was, is that, you know, one of the things that makes a lot of this tricky is once you accept the problem and you are moving forward to finding solutions, the solution space is actually really quite complicated. And the ability to be knowledgeable and skillful and effective at finding solutions that are commensurate to the size of the problem is really not been adequately focused on. And so he said, maybe we need a solutions literacy framework to complement climate, ocean, atmosphere, you know, all of them. And, you know, climate added a feature to that space when we came up with a guiding principle. But we really knew the guiding principle was just a kind of a placeholder. But unfortunately, the placeholder has never been fixed. And so it's an interesting idea. And I just wanted to kind of throw it out there and see if other members, and Don, you're on the call. I mean, this is with your rainbow work, a pretty interesting topic potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's alluded to in the Next Generation Science Standard framework, usually under the engineering area of designing solutions and the such, but I don't know. I mean, we've never really thought this one through and actually done anything with it. And I don't know what the end product is, and I don't know what the process is, but, you know, he tried to kind of twist my arm into saying, yes, I will help lead this initiative. So the question to you guys is...
I was a witness.
I witnessed.
Oh, right. Damn.
I love this part of the conversation.
That's even worse.
I love this turn of the conversation because I consider myself to be a culture change expert, and that's what we're looking at. We're looking at the diffusion of innovations. We're looking at how you take an entire culture and change it, and that's what we're doing. And the problem is that we forget that people have done this before, and we don't pay attention to what was done before. I worked, luckily, for 10 years in family planning programs in Korea and Taiwan, where we took an entire culture and changed it radically from son preference and six kids per family to all kids are equal and two kids per family. And we did that in a generation, and we did it in a planned way, and it worked. And I'm happy to talk about that at length. And I'll just shut up now because I would talk at length.
This is Jean McGregor. I would love to join a group of people to work on that framework. This is precisely what my project is oriented toward. And just to add another layer on it, in Western Washington, I'm building a project around not only the solutions in the abstract sense, but what are the solutions that we can actually see already happening right in our communities, in our bioregion. And so there's a very tangible thing about working with utilities, industry, municipal planning departments, and so forth, because it's on folks' radar here in a very, very strong way. And yet when you talk to faculty members, most of them are completely unaware. And furthermore, there's a lot going on in the NGO community around solutions also that, you know, it added up really amount to something. Although if you look at one at a time, it looks like a drop in the bucket. But when you think about communities committed to pedestrian walkways and bicycling, that adds up to a solution if you really begin to shift communities in those kinds of directions.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we reach Tom Bowman, or could we get him to be on a call, or how do we move this forward? Because I'm really interested in getting going with this in a collective way.
There's certain irons that are beginning to be put in the fire. And so really the point of this ask was to see if something like this was needed. So far I'm hearing a yes.
Yeah.
Maybe even a loud.
Yeah, and I would agree, Frank.
Huge yes.
It's a really, really big yes. And I think it's a yes across, I think it's a really complex notion in terms of, you know, from the skills building side to that vivid and concrete side that
that Gene is talking about. So, yeah, I agree. It's important.
Is that you, Bora?
It is, and I agree, and I'm on board.
Oh, look at that.
This is Kristen. Oh, go ahead, Karen.
Why don't you go first, Kristen, and I'll go after you.
Okay. I was just going to say, I just sent Tom Bowman's blog post that he must have written after he talked to you, Frank, just if folks want to get a little bit more background on that. But so one, from just a practical perspective, I'm extremely supportive of this. It's really the formula that an approach that we take when we try to teach teachers about teaching climate change. What I will say, though, and probably this reinforces why it's so important, is that we find when we do professional development for educators, we really emphasize the importance of integrating solutions when talking about climate change, because it's, as we know, so complicated and sort of and very depressing subject, and for students to have that, to know there are solutions, to empower them to come up with solutions. And when we come to the end of an institute, our evaluations always show that, you know, when we ask, you know, will you integrate solutions when you're teaching about climate change, and it's like a 99%, like, yes, of course we will. But when we follow up, it's the one that's least, the lesson that's least covered is the one that's on solutions. And so, A, I think we need to think about ways to do this, but one of the things that we've been trying to do is not make it an extra lesson, but how do we integrate it into each lesson so it's meshed in there, it's part of what you're learning, and there's a really clear connection between the science and the solution when you're doing that. Because I think people think it's important, but they don't know how to do it, which is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. What our family sustainability checklist, which you probably received when I sent out the Clean Network email earlier today, is a list of 60 things that families should do in order to reduce their carbon footprint and their water footprint. And that's what our program is focused on. The Climate Changes Elementary program is a solutions program. It's not a gloom and doom program, it's a hope and change program. And we tell the kids, we're going to have a clean, green future. The only thing we're trying to figure out is how to get there. So here's our list of 60 things that you could do. Go down the list, choose the ones that you want to do right away, and you have until you graduate from high school to finish your list. So you've got 7 to 12 years to finish your list. And, oh, by the way, you're in charge. Tell your parents what to do. It's your planet. So the kids love that. The parents kind of take umbrage at it, but the kids love it. And so by putting the kids in charge, we unleash the most powerful force in nature, which is the nagging power of children.
This is Karen. The question that I want to ask is one of clarification. And I think, Frank, what I heard you and Jean talking about is a framework for solutions, which to me is a little bit different than saying, this is the solution. And I just want to go back to Frank and see whether my perception is correct or whether you have some additional things to say about that.
So, I mean, this actually, I think it's more the latter. As a trained educator, it's not my job to tell somebody a solution, but it's more to the educationally appropriate one is to build the skills and knowledge and ability to find and execute the solutions with the resources that they choose. The choice is inside the student, not inside me imparting it. That's the thing that makes it different from propaganda and education, in my mind.
Great. I think that's important, because for me, the first thing that jumped out when you started talking about solutions is the difference for each community and each region of the country and the circumstances and all those complexities. And so I'm totally on board with a framework to guide people in moving towards solutions, which is what I think I hear you saying.
Absolutely.
As
and
opposed
this is Jean,
to
and I'd like
the
to
solution in all capital letters.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, I'm I'm in complete agreement. I think with the work that we're doing, we're actually, you know, looking at on-the-ground approaches without necessarily advocating for a particular way of doing it. But what I'm finding with college and university faculty members, even ones with pretty deep expertise about the phenomenon of climate change, they are completely unaware of King County's plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the City of Olympia's plan. Or, yeah,
or even governmental functions and how one can use them to proceed.
Or what's being discussed at the state level. And so this huge discontinuity between the science of the phenomenon and what might happen and the work that's already ongoing by governmental groups, industry, and the utilities, it's a staggering abyss. So I think contributing a framework that sets forward some questions about what can you look at in your community, municipality, state, region, utility, et cetera.
And providing models, you know, doesn't say this is the solution, but it says to be able to critique models that are out there, to say, well, how has it worked and where are the problems? That's part of that, you know, having case studies, having models, that's part of it being, you know, vivid and concrete for folks so that they have hopefulness, but they also have that hopefulness with the critical thinking eye.
And one thing just to pick up on what Dave, you said, was, you know, I think it's fair to say that we did not design the energy sector and the way we live intentionally to have the result we're having. It wasn't intentionally done.
Right.
It just happened one decision at a time, aggregated over time, that led to an unfortunate current configuration. And I think that one of the Tom Bowman presentations, that the one a couple previous to this with a Pratt School of Design and Sustainability talk, it's a brilliant talk. If you haven't listened to it, go and listen to it. But one of the things he said in that was that there's design principles that you have to intentionally put in to get a result that is meeting all our objectives. But that's, you know, where does that happen in school? Where do the kids learn these things to be intentionally designing a sustainable future? Yeah, as far as I can tell, it just doesn't happen. It's happenstance at best and minimal at that. So I think, you know, looking at, like, where in schools, who would do it, how would it be done, how does it fit into the other domains, so just a real concrete way, because I don't think we're doing it, which I appreciate your point, Kristen, about fitting it into the structure, but I'm also looking at what other structures are really needed here. I know it's a tall order, it's a higher bar, but I think that it might get us closer to the idealized position, if you follow where I'm going. Because I just don't think, I mean, as a trained science teacher, this has an impact. But I think in the next generation science standards, there's some in the engineering concepts that are definitely related to what we're talking about.
Well, I think, Frank, in your discussion with Next Gen, that there was some criticism of the engineering being not so much, being too much focused on building processes or building things as opposed to processes and systems of related to natural systems and models that don't involve building big concrete structures or a new package for something.
And robots.
And so I think that there's solutions sometimes are just drawing on processes and change that doesn't involve a product. So I think that would fit well.
Well, you know, I read them a little bit more broadly. I agree with some of the response, but if you read some of the, trying to find the which ones, high school, you know, the science and engineering, the engineering one, 1 through 4, ESS 3-2, life science 2-7, you know, and physical science 3-3. And if you read it with what we're talking about, it's there. There's enough anchor there to make something there. But the people who are currently teaching are going to see their there, not our there. And that's the trick.
And if you don't have good models or ways to instruct that are out there, people gravitate towards what's already available.
Exactly.
So I think offering them another option and a richer experience with what the standards, I would argue, call for, makes it less barriers to implementation.
Exactly. But I would also say that there's probably gaps in the way that these standards are characterized currently, because I mean it's imperfect by nature, right? And so what the things we do in this process might help improve what's there, but we'd have to go through a process to get to that. What do we all kind of commonly understand in that framework approach? So I can say, I mean, we can keep on going. I mean, we've got another 13 minutes, but officially together. But I'm hearing a solid yes. Is anybody else out there saying, it's not really needed, this is a waste of time, we're good to go? Any of that?
I'm sure such people exist.
I'm talking about on the call, Don.
Framework. There's a That's framework good. in what used to be called the Diffusion of Innovations study, which is how cultures change, that would be great to bring into the whole discussion and would give us a framework that we could use to move forward, because it really is a time-worn path that many people have traveled before. And so Diffusion of Innovations, Google it, look at the Wikipedia on it, and that's really what we should be doing. And unfortunately, when we first started this discussion, basically when Al Gore's movie came out, the Climate Project violated all the precepts of that Diffusion of Innovations approach, and instead of moving forward through the categories of innovators to early adopters, to early majority, to late majority, and working on a positive message, they jumped us all over to this battle between the deniers and the advocates. And that battle is totally useless and has no meaning whatsoever in the final outcome. That's why in the gymnasium on the wall, we hang a banner that says whether the climate is changing or not, and whether people are responsible or not, these children deserve a clean, green future. Let's get it for them. Because we sidestep the issue completely. We move the parents forward, and they aren't looking for the problem. They know the problem. They're looking for solutions.
I'd like to make sure that we also look at all the standards for the social studies as well as science, and not just limit it to science standards.
Hallelujah. Absolutely. I would also say the geography community have done some very fine work in this space.
Yep.
I'd also like to look at the 21st Century Skills Initiative to see if that still is carrying any water. And really, this is a meta framework in many ways. Mm-hmm. It's not. We shouldn't be pinned into the science piece at all.
Right.
No. We say when we go into a school, we're bringing the stream to the school. The stream is science, is technology, reading and writing, environmental science, arts, and music, and math. So we bring the stream to the school, not the STEM.
Good.
And we work with kids as kinesthetic, spatial, interpersonal, musical, environmental learners, which is what they are.
So just to add to the you said stream?
Stream.
Yeah. It's
R is reading and writing.
Right.
A is art.
I'm not a huge fan of the STEM and all the derivations, like STEM, STEAM, you know, all those. At some level, I think that a great education is what prepares you to, you know, for the challenges and opportunities climate change presents for us. Stop at education, because then we get, you know, what about music? Where's music in the stream?
Yeah.
And you're like, well, it's in there. But, you know, then in STEAM, and it's like,
there's a certain amount of we've been there, done that. You know, we had STS and STS, you know, E and all that sort of stuff back in the early 90s. But so we keep it's like we do the reinvent the wheel about every 20 years. Within education. You know, a friend of mine back in the co-op days used to talk about the bus to socialism. He was a socialist. Came around every 20 years. You know, and I think that's kind of what we do. But we've got STEM right now. You kind of live with it. But I agree with you, Frank. You know, it's really about a good quality education where kids develop these good problem-solving skills and are able to focus on important issues like climate change, but
right. You know, that's just, sorry, my soapbox. I'm getting off it.
Well, Frank, I just wanted to ask, what do you think is our next steps? Should we invite Tom to talk a little bit about this? Do you want him to sort of bring his sort of vision of this literacy framework?
Well, you know, so yes. I think that it would probably be a good idea. Well, I mean, yeah, that's the beginning of it. And I think that you know, if there was maybe a Google document is an easy place to, because we've mentioned a lot of things in this rich, you know, spontaneous conversation with a small subset of people. We had a great group and a rich conversation. But, you know, really, what are those, what are all the things that we need to make sure, like David put in a plug to not violate the diffusion of innovation model, you know, absolutely agree. But, you know, what are all the things that have to be in there? And then, you know, I don't want a long process. We don't have a lot of time. So, yeah. I mean, it took a long time to do climate literacy and energy literacy. Is there a way to kind of move a more expedited model? But not so. I think maybe the best thing to do next is to call a clean call with Tom,
yep.
and make sure that at least you guys on the call are around, and see, you know, what the next steps are, and when could we, you know, and Scott, you've done a lot of this convening work.
Yep.
I would imagine a virtual convening is a much more likely thing to happen than a face-to-face convening.
Yes.
As far as I can tell, the only next face-to-face meeting where some of us might convene spontaneously is NSTA. That's the next one, and then the next one doesn't wrap around until October is when the next, you know, that's our season. Maybe at NCSE in a couple weeks, but so I think virtual is going to have to play a critical role in this. But, you know, did you get your answer?
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, we can do kind of a kickoff perhaps with Tom, hopefully in February. I know that's sort of our next time. But we might want to move even more quickly than that. So
let's move.
A couple of us have a few ideas of how we might just get things started, and it will evolve as it evolves. But it's very clear everyone wants to go this way. It sounds like there's some pent-up energy to be more explicit about how we look at solutions. And I know, you know, this is certainly something that Mark McCaffrey has talked about for years. It's in part of the reason why we started recognizing that we needed to include energy when we did climate literacy, is we saw energy as a solution space. So,
right.
Yeah. Good.
So,
well, that seems quite a bit for 50 minutes, 55 minutes.
I want to make one more little thought that kind of relates indirectly to the discussion we just had. I threw some information on the listserv about a film we previewed in December that was spectacular. But I also wanted, there was some discussion maybe 2 months ago about argumentation and reasoning. And we're going to be hosting, hopefully, a workshop this summer at Ohio State. But there's a colleague of mine who's a principal now, but taught chemistry for 12 years. And she sent me a book from one of their English teachers that is absolutely phenomenal. And it would be great in science. It would be great in social studies. But as an AP, former AP teacher, I keep looking back and saying, I never could figure out why some kids could write better. And I knew some of the teaching, but there's a lot of things I didn't know about rhetoric and argument and reasoning. And so if anybody's doing anything with that, and I think the climate change community in using sources and documents to back up things, it's called Teaching Argument Writing, and I'll send a link up to the listserv. But it's by Hillux, who was a former teacher and University of Chicago professor. But literally, you can use all the materials directly from the book, but it almost teaches you as you go through the book how to select evidence, how to show how to teach students that through cartoons, using reasoning and warrants, how different lines of reasoning are backed up by different types of evidence that you have to provide support and definition for. But the gentleman who wrote the book has done a lot of work in the Chicago inner city schools. And I'm very impressed by what I've read. And we've been pretty excited in Central Ohio actually having a document that would service both science and social studies and writing for a lot of different areas of instruction.
That's awesome.
It's, you know, it's one of the classic disciplines is rhetoric. And we've really forgotten how to use it. At least explicit. That's great.
Well, and they're eliminating. I minored in graduate school in rhetoric, and they eliminated the department at the university when I left. So they're getting rid of it too.
But you know, in the
relatedly,
climate literacy. Go ahead, Don.
I was going to say, related to rhetoric, I'd recommend Joe Rahm's book, which. Has a long and weird name, but let me see if I can find it quickly here. Language, something about Lady Gaga and Jesus. go ahead, Frank. I'll pull it up here.
I'm waiting to hear the name of this one. In the definition of climate literacy we did was we added something built on the ocean literacy, which was know how to assess scientifically credible information about climate, which also connects to communicate about climate and climate change in a meaningful way. So, if you take those two definitional parts of what it means to be climate literate, they're really embedded in what you're talking about, but, you know, this is not the cornerstone of what we do in science classrooms. And so, it's implicit that this be, in other domains to get the skill, but usually the stuff we're talking about is science classroom, science teachers exclusively, and that's we're missing exactly what you guys are calling for.
Okay, you ready? It's Language Intelligence: Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga.
That's a good one.
Well, you said that.
Is there a link to it?
Yeah,
interesting.
Please send that one out. Others need to know that one.
WTFLOL. That's rhetoric today.
Well, thanks, everyone. It's the top of the hour,
thanks.
And I'll let us end on that note. And we can reconvene next week. And Tamara, I hope, is not going to be caught between Boston and Washington again, as she is today. And she's going to talk a little bit about collective impact, I think, building on some of the discussion that was held at AGU with many of us who are actually on the call. So hopefully most of you can join us next week, and others too, and talk to you then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Great. Super. Bye now.